This is Elias Wind Rider, and I never listen to the Order 66 podcast when I'm calculating terminal velocity.
This is Lass, and I never listen to the Order 66 podcast. I'm too busy putting up pictures of Sam Witwer on my wall. Sam, call me.
This is FXR, and I never listen to the Order 66 podcast, except for when I'm reprogramming myself. I could use the plus two insight bonus.
You hear that, Gamer Nation? This is the sound of Darth GM keeping these D20 radio dice a-rollin' by never listening to the Order 66 podcast. Oh, hey! Yahtzee, biatch!
With a correct amount.
D20 Radio, your gamer's role.
www.d20radio.com.
Execute Order 66.
This episode of the Order of the Order 66 podcast, brought to you by our sponsor, MapsOfMastery.com. Did you like that? You like how I screwed up the opening? You like that?
That was classic.
Wasn't it brilliant? It was absolutely brilliant.
Absolutely
anyway.
Brilliant.
I'm GM Dave, one of your hosts this evening for the Order 66 podcast. Yeah, that one. Episode 117 for...
16, here we go.
116? Really?
Yeah.
Okay, whatever you say.
Dude, you are on tonight.
I'm telling you.
I mean, you are on. I'm blown away. I'm utterly blown away.
Okay. I you know, I have no earthly idea exactly what I'm doing right now, because I'm just blasé'd, you know? I'm just completely blasé'd. So anyway, we're at episode 116 for September 15th, 2010. Oh, it's a beautiful Wednesday evening, and, you know, we're going to have some guys and some dudes and some people on the show, and we're going to have, like, a lot of stuff and...
Uh-huh.
And stuff. Anyway, so yeah, GM Dave, and this other guy you hear is, it's GM Chris.
What's up, Gamer Nation? Oh, yes, it is. It is. Dave, I'm going to end your blah. Do you know how I'm going to end your blah?
With Yuuzhan Vong.
No, we did that last episode.
Damn it.
I'm going to end your blah with the dulcet tones of a special guest, the first of a few that will be joining us tonight. From the wild mists of the intertubes, we are joined by, you should know him as Elias Windrider. Keith, what's up, man?
Not so much.
Not
I'm
so much.
I'm a little sick, but other than that, I'm okay.
Yes.
What are you sick with? What crud?
Coughing and sneezing.
Is it a cough due to cold?
is it a cough due to cold?
Cough due to cold. Jenny.
It's the Forrest Gump references. You got to watch him with us.
Yeah,
man.
You got to watch. You definitely got to watch all that. Otherwise, you know, that's it. It's over.
Well, dude, but you're in the Dallas area.
Yes, I am. I'm in Sheraton Hotel, Fort Worth, room 1212.
Oh, hey, party.
Party done. Show's over.
But you don't want to come here because I'm sick and I'll get you sick.
Oh, well.
Hey, if it's a good enough party, it could be worth it.
We can get sick together.
We can. We can all get sick together. And you guys can get sick with us, especially if you're tuning in for the very first time. And for those of you who might be, this is, of course, the Order 66 podcast, the only podcast devoted to Star Wars Saga Edition roleplay.
That's right. That dead game that'll never be back again.
Wow. That was unnecessary. I'm
in a snarky mood today.
Yeah, let's stop that.
Okay, fine.
What's up with that?
Accessing.
Ah, good. New acquisition.
Greetings, Gamer Nation. My designation is KCK Sim, and this is your Holo News Net update.
Beautiful.
A dead game that will never be back again. What the hell do you mean by that, sir?
I'm not entirely sure.
You have officially pissed me off. I'm calling you out. What do you mean by that?
Nothing.
Do you mean to say that no one is going to play this game ever again because
no.
Wizards of the Coast is no longer producing it?
Well, what I mean to say is exactly what I said. I believe the game is done and we're not going to see any more publications. I think you're making a hell of a lot more out of it.
Okay. I just, you maybe you are. Maybe I am, Dave. Maybe I absolutely am. I don't know.
Oh, did I ruffle your feathers? Did I ruffle your feathers at the baby boy?
No. This is the point of the talk. Okay, so maybe this is why I'm all feather ruffled. What was I listening to? I was listening to, I think it was RFI, and they were talking about an upcoming con that they're going to have be playing nothing but quote unquote dead games. and someone said, you know, just good at games that are out of print. They're not printing them anymore. And I said, well, was Star Wars Saga Edition included in that? And it's like, I don't know. It's kind of new. Well, yeah, but it's technically a dead game. So anyway, it just absolutely cracked me up.
Uh-huh. Well, you didn't sound too cracked up about it.
No. It cracked me up, but it pissed me off. I don't know. I just what quantifies a dead game? Is third edition a dead game at this point?
Yes. Yes, out of production to me is a dead game. That's it.
Okay.
End of story.
I'll buy that. Okay, Keith, what about you, brother? What's the Elias man's take on this? What quantifies a dead game?
Saga will never die.
Oh boy.
Oh,
here we
volume
go.
There.
Volume bad.
Volume bad.
Saga will never die.
Hey, freaking man, brother. Saga will never die. See, that's what I'm taking. That's what I like. It's there.
As long as it's alive in someone's heart, being played on a table somewhere. It is still alive. Okay.
So I'm either going to rebel against it, or I'm gonna like wholeheartedly champion the fact that it's a dead game. I don't know yet. We'll
All right.
See.
However you go, whatever it is that provides shock value for the show, that's the tack that I'll take right there.
I will buy that.
So I'll put up the spinnaker, and we'll head on downwind.
Oh man! Announcements.
We have a featured podcast this week.
Ooh.
I believe we do. And we are going to feature an epic episode from the boys at Chronicles, the Pathfinder podcast. They have episode 007 up. Yes, the James Bond theme music was abundantly present during the episode. And they had an appropriately epic guest, Sean Connery.
Okay, that would be awesome.
No. Was it a Schreiber? No. No, they had the publisher of Paizo Games, Eric Mona. Is it Mona? Mona?
Mona. Eric
Mona. Mona, right? Yeah, okay. So he reflects upon the cancellation of Dungeon and Dragon magazines, because it's not Dungeons and Dragon magazine. It's
there were two magazines.
And Dragon, like two.
Yes.
The success of the Pathfinder RPG, and a whole lot more. So, you know, the guys borrow, I would say, Eric's insight in a lengthy review of the module Eyes of the Ten, Part 1, Requiem for the Red Raven. Seeing how he wrote it. Asmus, Steel Wind, Mark, and Research are the guys on that show. They're in their usual form, dripping with awesome sauce.
Mm-hmm.
Yup. I think they take a look at the Dragon Disciple Ranger variant character concept and also roll out Pathfinder conversions of some classic Mind Flayer and demonic Cerebrillith. Sorry.
I can't pronounce it. I've never been able to pronounce it.
Yeah, I can't either. Don't know. Anyway, 3 hours, dude. That's why we say epic.
Epic episode.
3 hours, so.
Epic. Don't miss it.
Check it out. This and all podcasts, of course, you can be found at d20radio.com.
Keith, have you, I don't know if you play Pathfinder or 4th Ed or any fantasy at all. Have you had a chance to listen to Chronicles at all?
No, I haven't listened to Chronicles at all. I've played maybe 2-3 games of 4th edition. Before that, it was 2nd edition AD&D.
Wow, so you went from 2nd to 4th.
Yeah.
Wow. Dude, it's a good show. It's a really good show. Check it out. Awesome.
Yeah. I've got nothing else in way of news. Do you have anything?
No, nothing really big. All right. I don't know. Did we get any news reports this
week?
Well,
speaking of dead games and segments.
This is a Holonet News update. I'm Luke Lowbrow. Riots and looting have engulfed the Imperial Government Center following the Emperor's dissolution of the Senate. After Emperor Palpatine dissolved the Senate this week, thousands of laid-off political aides, legislative analysts, and janitorial staff began a quiet protest in the vast Imperial Senate building by simply pilfering office supplies, staplers, pens, post-it notes, and small electronics. Soon, roving bands of disgruntled former employees vandalized and emptied the basement vending machines. It did not take them long to realize they could also liberate the alcohol stores in the building's 14 restaurants, as well as empty the vast pharmaceutical supplies in the Senate's medical offices. What then resulted was an angry, drunken, and drug-soaked scene of debauchery, sin, and malice. Senate guards were called to confront the rioters when they were quickly informed their jobs were also lost when the Senate was dissolved, which prompted the guards to join the mayhem too. At this point, most of the senators were also participating in the riot. Even though they were not financially impacted by the layoffs, they had no intention of missing out on the public debauchery. One eyewitness report describes a fight that broke out when a Twi'lek senator made unwanted advances toward a 14-year-old female senator from Naboo. Supposedly, this Twi'lek made an obscene gesture with his Leku head tentacles, and later claimed he had no idea the girl was only 14, and went on to rant about why it was completely irresponsible for a planet to elect a 14-year-old girl to any position of planetary responsibility. The riot would continue for days. It hit its apex when the rioters organized chicken drag races outside the building, with the hundreds of Senate Rotunda repulsor pods once used by the legislators to make speeches on the Senate floor. Local law enforcement was called to intervene when the repulsor pod races began to disrupt Coruscant traffic flows. However, the highly persuasive senators on hand were able to deceive the police in believing that the Senate actually had not been dissolved, the drag races were merely a team-building activity, and the Senate would be happy to cut the funding for local law enforcement jobs if the police did not leave the rioters alone. Even a number of celebrities were also on hand. Pod racing legend Ben Quadaneros raced several times until his repulsor pod unexpectedly exploded in 4 equal pieces. Tonight's update has been brought to you by Tommy's Turbolaser Emporium. Don't buy a measly sissy laser weapon to defend your Star Cruiser. You need a turbo laser. What makes the turbo laser better than an average laser? Well, it's got the turb, and it's got the O that gives it the turbo. That makes it awesome. Everyone knows anything that's got turbo in its name is just better and cooler. You want to dabble in orbital bombardment? Get yourself a turbo laser. So come on down to Tommy's Turbo Laser Emporium. We're going to take your money, but you're going to walk out of here feeling virile. This has been a Holonet News Network update. I'm Luke Lowbrow.
D20 docking bay hosers. When it don't be making sense, we be making sense of it.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. D20 radio docking bay. Special thanks, obviously, to Luke Lowbrow, Dr. Dan. We appreciate it, as always.
Welcome back, Dan. That was awesome.
Yeah. Good to have you back.
Dude, why would they elect a 14-year-old to a governmental position?
I don't know, because she's
really hot.
I wasn't going to go there, but that's okay if you want to go there with a 14-year-old.
Well,
I was going to say very wise beyond her years, you know, and she was going to grow up to be Padme.
I guess.
She was going to grow up to be Natalie Portman, kind of hot.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
So yeah, if you want to look at it in a future perspective, kind of like, I don't know. All these people that
Destiny.
Wanted... What?
Kind of like Destiny?
Kind of like Density. That's right.
Kind of like Destiny.
Exactly. So, yeah. Something like that. All right, so D20 Dock and Bay, where we answer your questions put up on the forums, either by PM, by email, by calling the loser line, which is
206-600-5872.
Loser. L-U-S-A. Yeah. And we've gotten a few. Hey, we had three liners off the top of the show, which was awesome. I've got four liners, actually, off the top of the show. Three on the back of the show. So, very good, Gamer Nation. Keep them coming.
Thank you. Please, keep them coming.
Never listen, Yahtzee, biatch. That was a good one, too, pulling that one out from episode, like, 30.
Yeah,
that was
like
a long time ago.
I'm ashamed and yet glad someone remembers that story.
That's amazing. So our first question today comes from none other than Elias Windrider. I don't know who this person is, however. He asked a really hard question. And we have it in the show notes, but since we have Elias like on the show, I figure maybe you could just ask your question.
Which question is this? Because there were two.
This was about micro jumps.
All right.
The Picard maneuver.
The idea is...
The
idea is the audio cuts out.
The idea is that your microphone sucks. That's just what we're saying. I mean, it's not absolutely proven as of yet, but if it cuts out one more time, I'm ready to say that it sucks.
It's leaning towards the suckage.
We need to bring Sam on here so he can unsuck.
Elias, are you there, sir?
Yes, I am.
All right. All right, okay. Elaborate, sir.
All right, so a micro jump, it's an in-system jump. Do you actually need a Navi computer for this? I mean, can't you just point your ship in the right direction and go?
Good question. Okay, well, first of all, I mean, obviously, there's no rules in Saga for micro jumps, okay? Some of our listeners might be wondering, okay, micro jumps, like jumping to hyperspace and staying in the same system, when has that ever happened in Star Wars? Well, it's happened in the EU a little bit, and I do mean a little bit. I think it happened precisely twice. Anakin Skywalker used it to survive the Battle of Praeslin, and Luke Skywalker used that tactic when battling the Vong while defending Borlias. Those are the only times we've seen it used. It's not exactly...
Thrawn used it a bit in combination with gravity well projectors.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Thrawn used it for the gravity well. Thank you very much.
And Picard. I go back to Picard. Picard used it against the Klingons.
But the point being, it's not exactly common, or frankly, everyone would use it. Anytime we've ever seen anyone use it in the EU, they've been a tactical genius or... an ace pilot of epic proportions that also happens to be a Jedi with Jedi reflexes and Jedi insight. So I don't think it should be common. Now, when I started researching micro jumps and really getting into it, they do get into it in a little bit of detail in the books, talking about how you don't really plot a micro jump. Like you say, you're saying, well, can't you just point your ship in the direction and go? Maybe. So basically, you set a normal jump, but then you allow the planet's gravity to pull you back out of hyperspace, or in Thrawn's case, the gravity well generator. There's not a lot more detail given than that, but we can infer a lot. As we all know, hyperspace engines have warning systems that detect large gravitational bodies when you're en route through hyperspace, and they will purposefully drop a ship out of hyperspace when such a warning occurs to prevent you from, dying by... traveling through the mass shadow of a planet or a star. So it sounds to me like a micro jump takes advantage of that failsafe to execute this dangerous roguish maneuver. And I think it should be dangerous, Elias. I mean, what if it doesn't work? What if the distance is too close and your system can't drop you out of hyperspace in time? What if the failsafe fails and you just pass through a planet? So I think that's why it's not commonly used.
Right. It's not like Dustin Crops,
boy. Wasn't there also a couple in the X-Wing books?
I haven't read the X-Wing books. I couldn't tell you. But just based on my online research. But to answer your question, though, in terms of is a nav computer needed, I would say yeah, because I think you have to actually plot a jump. The point is to plot a jump and then just immediately get yanked out of hyperspace by the effects of the gravity field coupled with your warning system. Plus, I think a nav computer and a hyperdrive are kind of inextricably linked. I don't think you can... I'm not sure most systems could have one without the other.
They can. A lot of ships only have astromech droids, which store somebody's
jumps.
Yeah,
but that's technically a nav computer, in essence. But it stores jump coordinates. That's the point. The thing here, though, is with a micro jump, you couldn't really have that because you're jumping from one point to another specifically. If you're trying to plot a jump towards a gravitational body in order to then have its gravitational force pull you out of hyperspace, I think it would need some computing power. But that's my opinion.
Okay.
So there's that. Now, if I was to come up with some actual rules for this, first of all, I don't think I'd ever quantify rules that would let any character attempt it. There's many reasons for that. Thank you. Not the least of which is that I think it fundamentally alters a very well-tested Starship combat system by introducing a brand new element. If I had to do it, I wouldn't make it a standard rule. If I had to do it myself, it would be a high-level talent, most likely in the Ace Pilot's expert talent tree.
Chancellor, request a motion to suspend the rules.
Okay.
Thank you, Dave.
No problem.
Well, that's technically what it is. Yeah, if I was to create a brand new rule for this, I would make it a talent, probably in the Ace Pilot's in the Ace Pilot's talents, probably the expert pilot talent tree. Again, I think a nav computer would need to be required. But if I was to map out the talent, I'd probably call it micro jump. I'd probably have it have prerequisites in training and use computer, and probably just because I don't want some hot shit eighth level character taking this, I'd probably give it a prerequisite of the renowned pilot talent as well, which is semi useful. It's a good prereq. And if I were to word this talent, Keith, I would word it as once an encounter as a full round action. When piloting a starship with a working hyperdrive and nav computer, you may attempt to perform a micro jump. You must succeed on a DC 30 pilot check. Success, and your ship is instantly moved to a location up to 60 squares from its previous position, starship scale. If you fail, the action is wasted and you may not attempt a micro jump again this encounter. If you fail by 5 or more, you suffer the effects of a severe hyperspace mishap, which is detailed Table 1-1, page 13, Starships of the Galaxy. And I'd also say that you can only attempt a micro jump in a system, obviously, with a large planetary body or other suitable source of high gravity. So.
Yeah.
There's a lot of words.
That is a lot of words. And we apologize for not firing off the BBC warning in front, but my co-host asked me not to fire it off because... Yeah, it kind of gave us totally, license to cuss, and then all of a sudden,
I really have to apologize. I've been trying not to fire off the language anymore. Mm.
You know, Chris, I just remembered something.
Mm.
Back in the WEG books, one of the WEG books, they were talking about a strategy of using micro jumps, and in particular, they had broadcast the coordinates and they'd alter it by one or more, just so the fleet could jump out a short distance. And then recalculate jumps going somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that?
Not specifically. I could probably pull out my WEG books and look.
Yeah.
Yep. So anyway, all right. I liked your take on it.
Yeah, I think it's simple. I think it follows that KISS principle.
It's simple, but it's hard. It's hard to do in practice.
It's simple, but it is hard to do.
Okay, so Darth Kenobi has a question about experience awards. He says, I just heard an episode with map maker Chris West, and you guys said you tend to level the PCs by eyeballing. If a GM uses actual XP points, though, that's kind of a Department of Redundancy department, what are the guidelines? Meaning, can the heroes gain more than one level per adventure? I know D&D First Edition, the character stopped 1 point short of their second level gained, and if I wanted to run it that way, would it be cool? Considering that it can be kind of combo with eyeballing?
Hmm.
You know.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure which episode with the talented Mr. West you're referring to, Darth Kenobi. But when I refer to eyeballing, I'm referring to the amount of threats and thus experience gained in a session when you plan it out. In my games, I award actual XP based on the threats that are faced by my players, of course. I might increase or decrease the reward in an eyeball sense for maybe an especially hard or ridiculously easy encounter, or maybe story completion awards, good role-playing, but that's really where the eyeballing comes in. And I don't know. I think you can award XP any way you want. There's no official guidelines for it. They earn what they earn. This can this mean multiple levels after a session? Sure. I mean, unless you want to run it first edition, you know, D&D style, it's your call. I mean,
no.
Dave, I mean, what do you think? I mean, are you cool with experience as it goes, or do you think players should be limited to one level per session?
Nah, experience as it goes. I think it's, I mean, one per session is just, it's too constraining to me if you're doing a whole bunch of stuff. So, you know,
yeah.
You go as you go. You know, first edition is first edition. It's dead for a reason.
Then is Saga dead for a reason? Huh?
Saga is dead because of money.
Okay, I'll buy that. Keith, what about you, man? XP awards. You're GMing a game. How do you dole it out?
Okay.
See? There it is again.
Oh, okay. Your mic officially sucks, dude.
That's what it is.
Sorry. Full-on Gamer and I have a mutual friend. He goes by a screen name, Tramp.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
Wow.
You know what I think is happening is that the mic is over-modulating and then just flat dying.
I think so.
So, yeah, I think in this case, through broadcasting prowess, less is more. So
does that mean we quiet?
See, that came out perfect.
that came
all right. Out. As I was saying, Full-On Gamer and I have a mutual friend. I've never met Full-On. He sounds like a wonderful person.
He's a cool guy.
Yeah. Well, we have a mutual friend who goes by the screen name Tramp, and he was a GM for me under RCR, and I will never play with him again. He used the rule of one level per adventure, and had adventures span multiple sessions.
Okay.
That's stupid.
And that was horrendous. Among other things, so I don't like adventure rule.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of that either.
No,
so
I'm not. It, I think you should just dole it out as you go, man. That's cool. I did run with a GM once who didn't even measure XP and just eyeballed his encounters to make significant threats for a session, and then just automatically awarded a level after each session. I've seen that too. But yeah, once again, there is no official guideline. It is your call as a GM, Kenobi. So
awesome.
There you go.
All right, and for these and much more, please tune in to the D20 Radio Docking Bay or go to the forums. D20radio.com/forums. Hit us on email or hit us Skype or phone. 206-600-5872
LUSA.
How about
I think we have
apples?
I think we have time for one more question that I know Elias wanted to ask.
All right. Which is
up close and personal, sir. What was that other question?
The other question was a while back you had mentioned about Starship Combat that you had some method of adjusting experience based on the CL of the ships the characters were piloting. Could
yeah.
You go through that again?
Absolutely. The answer for that, you know, once again, how to adjust experience for starships, the answer is found on page 35 of Starships of the Galaxy, the very last paragraph called Challenge Level Adjustments for Starship Disparities. And it's got a formula, pretty much, that I'll go through again if you'd like. First, calculate the CL, the challenge level value, of the hero's vehicle. Okay, or at the average value if there's multiple vehicles they're in. Okay, unless the heroes have the aid of a generic crew, such as like when they're on board a capital ship, subtract the CL modifier for the crew's quality from the given CL for the vehicle, and check the crew quality sidebar, which is on page 174 of the Saga Edition Core Rulebook. So you have this number. Okay, take that number, divide by 2, and then round down. Of all things. Then subtract that result from the CL of all the opponents in the encounter. The new result is the enemy's adjusted CL. So you're not so much adjusting the CL of the party members as you are adjusting the CL of the enemies. That adjusted CL can be used to determine both difficulty and the rewards, like experience, credits, whatever, for an encounter. So it's just taking advantage of, or taking into account, the powerfulness of the ship the heroes are piloting, or ships, to adjust the CL of the foes they're fighting accordingly. And that's how it's done. But if you guys want to take a closer look at that, once again, page 35, Starships of the Galaxy.
Beautiful. All right, we're going to stop down for Fragments from the Rim right now, and then we're going to be back, and we're going to get a couple of guests on, and we will continue talking about good stuff. I'm not going to pull the curtain back just yet. But we'll see you on the other side.
My lords, welcome to Fragments from the Rim. What is thy bidding, my masters?
It's that time again. I'm Darth GM, and this is episode 61 of Fragments from the Rim. This episode is mostly going to be for the GMs, but you players may enjoy the subject matter too. It's my humble opinion that you can't have a Star Wars campaign without a liberal helping of starship combat. Every movie starts in space, the camera panning to some ship arriving at a planet or engaged in combat with an adversary. But running space combat in Saga can get tricky. At higher levels, the PCs have their ships so tricked out that out-of-the-book opponents are more of a nuisance than a threat. I found that following the rules for starship maneuvers gives my NPC ships a nice little bump. It makes them more of a credible threat, as well as making them more interesting for my PCs to fight. But while characters only have to worry about the maneuvers that they have, a GM is running multiple enemy craft, and can sometimes get overwhelmed trying to keep track of various maneuvers each individual ship may have. I have found one maneuver in particular that is easy to keep track of, makes the enemy starfighter more of a threat, and makes him a fun opponent for the PCs. Strike formation. It's an attack pattern, meaning that once you activate it, the ship gains that benefit of the power until they decide to end it or activate another attack pattern. While strike formation is active, all weapons on that ship deal an additional 1 die of damage, but take a -2 to their ship's reflex defense. It's a swift action to activate, needs a piloting check with a DC of 20, and lasts until a swift action is spent to end it. In one of my games, the PCs have a freighter and an accompanying starfighter. They've acquired the best shields that they can fit into a colossal freighter with a shield rating of 55. They also have 4 gun emplacements on the ship. While the pilot and the soldier, trained in heavy weapons, have no problem hitting enemy craft, everyone else in the party suffers a -5 to their attack rolls when trying to defend the ship. On the other side, most enemy craft they come up against are firing weapons with a base damage of 5d10. The average damage of those weapons is between 27 and 28, and multiplied by 2, that's barely enough damage to get through their shields, never mind the damage resistance of the ship's hull. With the enemies not able to threaten the PCs, and half the PC party unable to hit the enemies, space combat tends to drag on and be a bore for many in the party. With strike formation, the enemies are more of a threat, meaning every shot that hits has an increased chance of dealing a little more hull damage. And it lowers their defenses, so the gunners who are firing with a penalty have more of a chance to participate in and enjoy the space combat encounter. According to page 29 of Starships of the Galaxy, any ship with a skilled crew rating can get one maneuver. If you find yourself running space combat encounters that sound a lot like my previous example, consider giving enemy fighters this maneuver. Time to break formation, Gamer Nation. If you have any questions, contact me at d20darth@gmail.com. Until next time, 20 side up, 1 side down.
You have been listening to Fragments from the Rim and Transmission.
Thank you very much, Mr. GM Phil. And now, joining us from the land of the stew of the gnomes, well, Chris, I will let you introduce our two famous, the third and fourth most famous guys ever to be on the Order 66 podcast.
Uh-huh.
Maybe.
Got that right. Right after Checker, Assistant Sam...
Whitwer, yeah.
So we're saying that. Well, tonight we are very pleased to welcome two very special guests, both head honchos in the design and development of a freakishly cool supplement that we are going to be talking about tonight. And more commonly, they're known as just plain old gnomes. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us on.
With us right now, we have Martin Ralia. And Phil, I want to pronounce your last name correctly. Is it Vecchione?
It's pretty close. Vecchione.
Vecchione. Got it.
See, I would have gotten that right because I have a friend named Vecchio.
And you got mine right, which nobody does, so kudos.
Well, hey, we've known you as Martin Ralia since we've known you. And that's been a long time.
How do people usually mispronounce your name?
For some reason, they transposed the Y and the L.
Rayla?
Rayla?
Uh-huh.
Wow.
Like 90% of people. I have no idea why.
Really?
It's only five letters. Two of them are the same.
That's trippy. Well, okay. Wow. Readers of Gnome Stew, Phil, they'll know you as DNA Phil on the blog, yes?
That's correct.
Okay, excellent.
DNA.
Well, as I said, you know, most of our listeners already know about Gnome Stew, the critically acclaimed, much-loved game mastering blog. I've been reading you guys for a while, and we were very fortunate enough to have fellow Gnome Matt Nagley on our show a while back to talk Star Wars role-playing and overcoming the challenges in a canon-heavy system. We also lit him up something fierce. It was a great, great episode.
That's
a great
right.
discussion.
The Star Wars should die in a fire episode.
Yes, for his blog, why the concept of a Star Wars RPG should die in a fire. I was like, we got to get him on the show. But it was a good article, and it had a very, very good point. It was a good conversation, so I'm looking forward to continuing the tradition, so to speak.
So did you guys win an any this year or what?
Yeah.
We did. We took silver.
Dude.
We're very happy.
Grats. You see, those of us who have silver Ennies, it's an elite club.
Yeah, it is. I mean, from one Ennie Award winner to another, congratulations.
It's exclusive. Congratulations.
Right back at you.
You're part of a very exclusive club.
I've only recently let my wife stop calling me the Ennie Award winning husband around the house.
See, and I could never get mine to do that.
Really?
I must be doing it wrong, Phil.
No, I think it's a good thing, Martin. That could get awkward in certain situations.
Wow.
It is a little long, you know. If we're in a fire, I don't want her to say the Annie Award-winning Martin Ralia. Just, you know, cut it short.
Yeah. True that.
Well, see, my wife is still, you know, when we're going out to social events or she introduces me to coworkers, she still introduces me as the Annie Award-winning. So, I you know. That's good. It's been a year.
It's really weird in public, dude. I'm just saying.
I know, but that's part of the way I roll now.
No pun intended. Oh!
Celebrate. Celebration.
Celebration, no pun intended.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so obviously the industry recognized you guys with the award. The fans recognized you guys with the award. You have some much deserved respect and cred in the gaming industry yourselves. And you do a damn fine job. But I guess before we get going, tell us a little bit about yourselves. I kind of want to know about you and what you do for the blog. I mean, I guess starting, Martin, I know you're the gnome in chief, but dude, you're a pretty well-published freelancer. I mean, you've written for what? You've written for Dragon. You did stuff for Dragon Mech, Tabletop Adventures, EN Publishing, Expeditious Retreat. You've got a lot of varied work out there.
Yeah, I started freelancing in 2004. Started Treasure Tables, my previous blog, in 2005, and that's actually how I met all of the other authors on Gnome Stew, was through Treasure Tables in one way or the other.
Nice. Now, as far as the blog itself for Gnome Stew, as Chief Gnome, what is your role?
So I contribute articles just like the other gnomes, and then I handle all the kind of back-end administrative BS that they don't want to deal with.
Gotcha.
Oh, yeah, I know that. I know that feeling.
Dave knows that feeling all too well.
Yep.
Oh,
somebody all right back there?
The cough. Poor Keith. I feel so bad for you.
I know, dude. I hate it.
Oh,
I hate it. I hate it.
We hates it.
We hates it. It burns. It freezes. Yep.
So, Phil, I mean, obviously, aside from your excellent articles as a gnome, I mean, dude, you're a pretty hardcore lifelong gamer. You're a noted GM. You've spoken on panels at Gen Con, and I think I may actually have met you or one of the other green shirts at Gen Con 2 years ago. So, dude, what is your role for the blog? How did you get involved in all this?
So, I've been a GM, I think I'm edging up on 30 years now. I'm trying not to think of it in terms like that, but I'm getting really close to 30 years as a GM. And I was a regular reader of Treasure Tables, frequent commenter, and I think at some point towards before Treasure Tables went offline, I think I did a guest post or two with Martin. But I think it wound up chatting up Martin before that, and yeah, I had started doing talks at Gen Con simply because they'll let you if you post, they'll They'll give you a room and people will go in there. And so I did. I just started talking about stuff that I really, you know, found interesting. And then I did a couple of panels. I did we did a few years. We did the GM Foo panel, which had a couple of different people on it. I was on it. Zach from RPG Blog 2 was on it with Martin and I, and Vicky, who is one of the editors over at Tabletop. And then I think we switched it up again. Vicky and I did a workshop one year with the Chatty DM on game prep. Yeah, and so just year after year, I made it a point to just go to Gen Con and, you know, go stand in a room and, you know, self-inflate my ego. But really just to give out GMing advice. And then when it came to Gnomes 2, I think all of us, if you've ever read the comic book Global Frequency, it's probably the closest analogy. Everybody just got an email from Martin one day saying, I'm starting up a blog called Gnomes 2 and I want you to come write for it. And at that point, you accept the offer.
Nice. Where the horse head follows.
Yeah, I actually shut down my other blog. I had just started a blog inspired after Treasure Tables, and I think I was probably writing to an audience of like 10 people. And I think I kept my blog up for like a couple months and realized it was ridiculous. I was writing half of my good material to an audience of 10, or I could put it on Gnomes 2, and then it was just pointless. I shut my site down and moved everything over to Gnomes 2.
That's perfect. So, all right. So tell us a little bit about how many gnomes do you have? And you guys have been up, what, since for a couple of years now?
Yeah, it was 2 years as of May 12th of this year. We started with 9, lost 2 and gained 1. That would make 8. So I must have my math wrong. Adam Nave, who was part of the site early on, left after a few months. And then Patrick Benson left after a bit over a year. He was definitely here for the any winning year. Nice. And then Don Mappin joined us a couple months ago. So
fantastic.
I think it's 9. I lose track. It's like herding cats.
Yeah, I think we started with 10.
Yeah, I think you're right. We started with 10. It was a nice round number.
See, there you are.
Very cool. So talk to us a little bit about the blog itself, because I mean, hey, a lot of our listeners know what Gnomes 2 is and they're probably already on their way looking at it, but if you had to encapsulate what the intent was for someone who's never heard of it before, you know, what would you describe it as? What's the goal of the blog?
It's to provide system neutral game mastering advice, tips, tricks, ideas, Q&A for GMs of all skill levels, all experience levels. We don't care what you play or how you play it. We just want to help make it more fun. And we always strive to be all signal, no noise.
Now, I'd like to expand on that, if you would, because this is one thing that I really do enjoy and why I and another GM who run completely different things can get so much out of Gnomes 2. You mentioned system neutral, that it doesn't matter what you play. That's not easy. it's not, but you guys have found a way to do it. And that's impressive. I mean, do you guys have regular games that you play, preferred systems, or do you prefer to, sample everything and play what you can when you can?
Everybody kind of has their own approach. I mean, we all sort of do it 9 different ways. Phil's a big game slut. He plays lots of different things. Troy, I think, pretty much only plays 3-5 regularly. Most of us are kind of somewhere in between those two.
Yeah, Kurt's pretty much Savage Worlds dedicated player. Yeah, I'll play something for like a year or so and then I move on. So yeah, I'm probably the game slut of the group.
Yeah. Gotcha. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm an aspiring game slut. If I could find a group that wanted to play anything but Star Wars, I would.
Yeah, and my shelf definitely aspires to sluttiness, but, you know, it just doesn't always work out that way.
Okay, after this, I'm going to take that line out of the show and put that in your and just create a liner for you. I'm Martin Aurelia, and my shelf aspires to sluttiness.
Excellent.
Oh, that's brilliant.
My family will be proud.
Oh,
indeed.
Very nice. Well, okay, let's get to the meat then, guys. So We're here to talk about one thing in particular, Eureka. 501 Adventure Plots to Inspire Game Masters. The reason we have you two on the show today. So, Noam Stu, what, you guys recently released your very first full print publication? I don't believe you guys have released anything before this, yes?
Nope, we haven't. A really appalling free adventure and some stand-up gnomes.
Would that be Gnomes Gone Wild?
Oh, yes.
Yes, I read it.
So far, we've never heard of anybody actually playing it, which is probably for the best, but the challenge is still out there.
Oh. Gauntlet picked up, sir. Very nice. So this book is getting a lot of acclaim. It's an over 300-page tome containing nothing but very well-written plots and hooks for game masters, as you put it, the system neutrals, game masters for any system of any stripe. The buzz over this book in the community has been huge, and when I first looked at it, I thought it was one of the best GM supplements that I had seen in a very, very long time, something I think every GM should have on his shelf. So let's talk about it. Now, Dave, I know I shared my copy with you, and you are much more of a player than you are a GM, but you know, I know that you're in the throes of planning your first campaign right now.
Yep.
What were your initial impressions of the book?
The initial impressions were basically, in my mind, because I'm not a very experienced GM, it was almost too much to take in, because there are so many ideas that you find yourself, oh, I want to do this. No, I'm going to do that. No, I'm going to, no, no. Ah, forget it.
In retrospect, that's not exactly a bad problem.
No,
to have.
It's not a bad problem at all, especially when you're a seasoned GM, you've got all these ideas, right? And so somewhere in the creative process, one idea has to win out. I just had a real hard time finding the one idea because there are lots of great ideas. I mean, I didn't get through the whole thing, but I mean, I saw at least in the few, I guess maybe about halfway through the book, at least 50 plots that would work for sci-fi. And I can imagine in the rest of the book, which you know probably was 2/3 of the books, there had to be. In excess of maybe a third of the book that would work.
I don't know. They actually have a chapter devoted to it, just sci-fi gaming in and of itself.
Yeah.
But, we're alluding to this based on our initial impressions. You know, Martin, Phil, talk to us. What's the point? What is this book about? What can this readers get out of it?
Do you want to take this or do you want me to
see who talks?
Yeah, go for it, Phil.
Yeah.
So this is a book, when Martin pitched this to us, so much like joining Gnome Stew, we get an email from Martin one morning that says, hey, I got this idea. And this is the idea that I want to make a book of plots, not hooks, but developed plots that are about 400 words long. So long enough that you can have a beginning, a middle, and an end, but short enough that it is... there's still room for the GM to actually put their own spin on the story. And I want it system neutral. And I don't want anything named specifically. I want it to be able to be dropped into anyone's game regardless of what they're playing. Oh, and I want to do it for fantasy. I want to do it for sci-fi. And I want to do it for horror. And we should be able to interchange different genres for all of them as well. So that's what the initial pitch was. And I think all of us were like, what? And I think there was a few moments of silence and then about 60 or 80 emails that followed in that day, asking questions, checking it out, etc. But that's the point. The idea is that if you're a game master and you need to prep something really quick, pick up the book, open it up, pull out a plot, flesh it out a little, add some NPCs, and boom, you're off and running.
Nice. Now, as far as our own listeners go, Star Wars gamers, there's 167 generic plots in this book specifically for sci-fi gaming, yes?
Yep, and then one of the things that we did was identify which plots are easily adaptable to other genres and subgenres. So if you include all of those, now granted, not every one of those will be Star Wars appropriate, but it's such a big universe that a lot of them will. 420 out of the 501 are quite easily adaptable to sci-fi. And with a little more elbow grease, the other 81 are certainly accessible to you.
Nice. So that's a lot of plot. I dare say that's a whole lot of plot. And I guess talk to us about the creation. So, I mean, obviously you had this frantic email idea go back and forth and, you know, emails and all that. What was the creative and production process like? I mean, this is a pretty feisty undertaking, guys.
It was awesome at points and totally insane at points. We did a lot of upfront work, probably more than you would think goes into a book of plots, because if we sat, you know, nine guys down to write 500 plots, there'd have been duplication. We'd have been all over the map about what was what. So one of the first things that we did that made a big difference was build a spreadsheet with, we haven't actually talked about this yet, but the 36 dramatic situations is the kind of underlying, I don't know, glue that holds the book together.
Well, no, let's get into that. Tell us about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, let's nibble on that for a minute, because the rest will make sense after that. So early 20th century, like around 1915 or so, I forget the exact year, this French guy, Georges Palti, says, there are only 36 plots in the world. Every story ever written fits one of these 36 categories. Puts out this slim little book called The 36 Dramatic Situations, and that's that. You know, that's the whole idea. And we love the idea. We didn't necessarily agree with all of it, but it gave us a really strong hook to hang sets of plots on. So this giant spreadsheet basically broke out, this author is going to write plots for these situations, for these genres, such that every author wrote every situation for every genre in some form, as close to that as we could get. So it really helped us ensure diversity, if that makes sense.
I think one of the other things that really helped in the beginning was after the initial design storm, I think is a good term for it, we stopped and everybody wrote five plots from any one of the 36 situations, and we pooled them all together and just took a look to see how it was going to go. And I think that was like the first testing of the water to see if this was really if this idea had legs or not.
Yeah, and we introduced some refinements based on that. The tags and genres idea, dramatically different originally than as executed. I think it came out a lot better, and that proof of concept that Phil just spoke about is a big part of that. So there's a lot of back and forth. I mean, you put nine creative people together, you get a lot of back and forth, and we think we turned out a good product as a result of it.
Definitely. Well, and as I'm going through, I'm flipping through myself, and I can, it comes together because there's obviously 500 plots in here, but 501, but I can see they're grouped within their own chapters, you know, fantasy, sci-fi, horror, etc., by what seem to be these meta plot concepts you're talking about, you know, supplication, deliverance, crime pursued by vengeance taken for kindred upon kindred, you know, things like that.
Ah, kin versus kin.
Kin versus kin. Sounds like a really bad blood feud between, you know, two Star Wars characters. Pretty much. Murderous adultery. Self-sacrifice for an ideal. You know, things like that. Was the intent to... let's break for a second, talk about value. Any GM worth their stones can throw together a table of bad guys and just wing it. But that's not enough to make a good game. You need to have, you need to have a proper plot. You need to have a proper story. But what struck a chord with me personally with this when I was reading it was in the way in which you divide this up among these various, you know, meta plots is that every plot, every story has this key emotional theme. And so if a GM wants to capitalize on that, they can at a glance go to that theme here and, wow, this is designed with that theme in mind. I thought that was a marvelous choice. Kudos.
Thank you. No, that was one of the things that we really liked about it. Even, you know, whether the theme is strongly or weakly expressed in the plot, it's always there. You can pull that thread as much as you want. And all of Palti's situations are fundamentally about people being mostly naughty and occasionally nice to each other, which works really well for role-playing because it's all about the PCs and the NPCs they interact with and the stories that result. So you almost can't get a bad plot out of his situations.
Gotcha. I do remember in the beginning phases, we were looking through the book. One of the challenges was the book is not an it's a thin book. It's not the easiest of reads. And then the hardest part is that all the references are from 1905 and books, you know, before that. So unless you're like an English major, you're reading through it and it's naming all these books. And I'm like, I don't know. My background's in biology. I have no idea what any of these books are. And then I went and talked to my wife who has a degree in English and she didn't know what half those books were. And so I know there were, you know, there were times where we were, you know, sending out messages to each other about, well, what exactly is, you know, situation 35 or something. Can somebody sum it up? Can somebody explain it?
And the answer was usually, as long as it feels like it fits that situation, it's whatever the hell you want it to be, you know.
Yeah, some of them were, and some of them were easier to write for than others.
Okay, such as?
What did I like the most? Kin versus kin wasn't bad, but after a while you had to make sure that you didn't just have two brothers trying to kill each other. That was a... It was like an easy pitfall. Mm.
It's almost a classic fantasy trope, you know. The king is dead. His two brothers are, you know, fighting for the throne. I think I've played that module several times. So yeah, I guess keeping it original is what's interesting. And I think you guys have done a good job. I mean, as I go through this, it's pretty freaking cool. You managed to also, to continue this, in terms of what differentiates this from any other old GM supplement, aside from the plot organization and the whole meta-plot idea, you managed to compress a lot of really good info in, what, half a page for each plot?
Yeah, we came up with a template that I think everybody wanted to throw against the wall before they were done writing their portion, but... once a little distance had accumulated and we look back on it, we're like, all right, this really does work. It's got to have at least three discrete encounters, up to five, an intro slash hook, and anything else you would need to run it well. And that's a lot to squeeze into 400 words. That was a real challenge for a lot of us was, you know, you'd sit down and you'd write it like, oh, this is perfect, and it's 1,000 words. Now what? So it really helped us get down to kind of the very essential elements of the plots and just the meatiest things for the GM to grab onto.
All right, so I noticed that in you know, we talk about these half page templates that y'all have, right? That we, you know, basically there's two storylines per page, and at the bottom of each one you've got easily adapted to, and you've got tags. Tell us about the tags a little bit. Easily adapted to, I understand. You know, you can use this for lots of other genres or whatnot. So where did you get the tags from, and can they search by it?
Phil, do you want to roll with that one?
Yeah. So the tags we put together through group consensus of different elements that occurred in all the stories, and that was hashed out during the writing of the plots. We went through all the tags, and then I believe it was Martin and a few others went back after the initial writing was done and applied the tags to all of the plots. And the purpose of it is that in our chapter of indexes, there is an index by tag. And so if there is a particular type of story you're looking for, like, for instance, the tag betrayal, you can go to the index and find all of the plots that have to do with betrayal. And so this way, as a GM, if you're looking... you know, if you're thinking, I want to do a game and, you know what, I need it to be in an isolated location, you actually can go right to the book and find plots that deal with isolated locations.
And I've got to give huge kudos to Matt. He was our design lead for the tags, and he also did all four of the indexes, which were an enormous amount of work that we had originally planned to do by hand. And I think he saved probably me from slitting my wrists because he did an awesome job on them.
But you have to understand how awesome a resource that is to be able to, you know, I want to do something about X and be able to search for that.
I'm playing around with the PDF right now, and I'm thinking to myself, you know what? I want to plot about betrayal. I went into the PDF. I hit Control F or whatever, go into the find box. I type in betrayal and just next, and it's taking me plot by plot through the tags for each one that's got a tag of betrayal associated with it.
Yep.
Fantastic.
Or you can go to the index, right?
Yep. Same thing. Whether it's physical or PDF for the paper.
You know.
I'm going for the more technologically savvy solution. Well,
of course, because you've purchased the PDF bundle, which I have not had.
I feel haughty. I'm haughty.
Never heard you described that way before.
Yeah, I have to say, I know when we saw the PDF, because you know we had seen it a couple weeks before it went up on the site. None of us had seen the actual print book at this point. The PDF is the first thing that's compiled, and that's what goes off to the printer. And I remember opening up the PDF, and I was like completely blown away about, you know, between the tags and the indexes, it was so unbelievably usable as an electronic resource. I love both of them. I have, you know, I obviously have a copy of the book and I have the PDF of the book, and I would say I go between both of them equally.
Well, and Darren Hardy, who is our graphic designer, did the PDF layout as well. One of the things that we really wanted to emphasize and that I think he did a great job on was making it a truly usable electronic book, not just, well, you know, we have this PDF lying around because we had to send the book to the printer, so here you go, $16.95. It's fully hyperlinked. It's fully bookmarked. You can use the table of contents to jump to any theme in any chapter. It's bookmarked as extensively as you need it to be.
Absolutely fantastic. Okay. Talk to me about something that's going to be near and dear to our readers' hearts. Let's delve into a more concrete examples here with the book. Let's say I'm a GM who wants to run a Star Wars game. How easily or what ways could a GM easily use this resource to help their Star Wars games? I mean, I noticed the space opera adaptation tag. That might be kind of helpful. But, I mean, if you're going to run a Star Wars game, what's the first thing you do when grabbing this book? How are you gonna work through it?
Well, I do one of two things. The space opera tag is perfect. And there you could just go straight to the index and flip back and forth, use that to browse the space opera plots. Or you could just, you know, let the book fall open or start at the beginning of the sci-fi chapter. Like I said earlier, I mean, Star Wars is such an open universe in a lot of respects that many of these plots will work more or less just as is.
Excellent.
Yeah, that flipping it open and letting the book fall, I call that Eureka Roulette.
Nice.
One of the other things you can do for it is in planning for a campaign, and we did this as like a little giveaway at Gen Con this year, was take four plots right out of the book and add a little background, string them together, and you've got a playable campaign, and depending on how many times you play in a month, four plots can stretch out to something like about 6 to 8 sessions. And that's not a bad campaign arc to start off with.
It's not bad at all. Dude, excellent. So I have to ask, what is your favorite plot in the book? Do you have one?
Well, Phil, I'll go ahead and embarrass you because my favorite plot in the book is one of Phil's. It's a horror plot. It's called The Party. Not terribly Star Wars suitable, but I just love it. It's plot number 495, and it's about a sort of a supernatural being that essentially is the ultimate party. And it roams around sort of recruiting people and then draining them because it's a kind of psychic vampire. To me, it feels like a very sort of Buffy episode plot in a really good way. But you could also stretch it to just about any aspect of horror that you want to pull out and make it as mean or nasty as you like.
Nice.
For my pick, I'm going to go with a fantasy plot that Patrick Benson wrote called For Glory, Nothing More, and it's plot 36. And it's basically about a light that appears on the horizon, and everybody's kind of racing towards the light because they don't know what it is. And the thing I love about the plot is that Patrick doesn't actually tell you what the light is. And it's like a great kickoff to a story arc.
Gotcha. I like it. Okay, so aside from general plots, do you have a favorite sci-fi plot?
I'm now going to embarrass Martin because I'm actually running one of Martin's
plots.
Damn
it, Phil. My ego is large enough.
I'm actually running one of Martin's plots Friday for a game of Corporation that I'm running. It's plot 263, and it's called Infestation. And it's about some nanites that have broken loose on a station and essentially are taking people over. And with a little twist, I've now got nano zombies created. And so I'm about to unleash them on my players this weekend.
We need to call Wesley Crusher.
But
I actually had trouble picking a favorite sci-fi plot because I love sci-fi games in general. But I would go with Heavy Cargo. It's
dude, that's the one that reminded me.
Just reading that one.
That was the one that reminded me of Sam's story that he told.
Yeah.
It's a very Star Wars plot, too. I've got the book sitting open in here. It's 221. And, yeah, it's the PCs are offered the classic setup, you know, a substantial payment, take this box somewhere, don't tell anybody what it is, and don't look inside. And they find this smuggling ship adrift, the car is, and it jumps from one thing to another with that. It's really a story about a gravity bomb that the military is tethered because, you know, they're smugglers. Who cares if they disappear?
Right.
Beautiful.
Dude, I love it. Well, guys, lastly, to I guess bring this conversation to a close, this is a fantastic resource. We want to thank you for coming on and talking with us about it, getting this information out there just so people can really take advantage of it. If people would like to locate the book, where can they do so? And the bigger question, how much does it cost?
So we've got several options. I'll back into it. It'll be in retail stores in December. The solicitation cycle for distribution takes about 4 months. And, you know, we approach them towards the end of our publishing cycle. And probably should have been sooner, but, you know, hey, it's our first rodeo. So you'll be able to buy it at your local game store. We work with Studio 2 Publishing for fulfillment. And they, in turn, work with every distributor under the sun. So if you tell your game store you want a copy, they can get you one. To buy it right now, the Engine Publishing website, which is just enginepublishing.com, spelled how you think it would be. We sell the PDF directly for $16.95, and then the bundle. We don't offer the print without the PDF because we don't think you should have to pay for content twice. So that's $34.95. That's the cover price for the book, and you get the PDF on the spot for free. And then, of course, you can also go to DriveThruRPG. Paizo.com and RPG Now and pick up the PDF for the same price for $16.95. And it's worth mentioning, I think, that it's DRM free. Again, we would rather have customers than people we think are terrible thieves. So you can cut and paste, you know, use the plots to build outlines for your adventures, however you want to pull the PDF apart for your own use. That's something we encourage.
That's nice.
Awesome. Yeah. Fantastic.
Fantastic. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much again for taking your time and talk with us. And all of you listeners out there, check out the book, and more importantly, check out Gnome Stew, any award-winning game mastering blog and an amazing resource. And yeah, it's a good thing.
Thank you so much for having.
Oh no, it's,
no, it's all right. You can.
Thank you so much for having us on. It's a real chore listening to people say nice things about your work for an hour. So
nice.
Yeah.
Perfect. Yeah, you can always talk over the sad piano music. It's just it's a rite of passage to the end of the show.
Yes. Talking over the sad piano music makes us all feel a little bit better about ourselves. That's kind of why we do it.
It's very soothing.
It is very soothing. Keith, are you and your sick self still with us? I don't know if he is.
I think he's sleeping.
We've lost Keith.
I think we lost
Keith.
We've
lost him. Damn it, I'm a doctor, not a director.
We lost Keith, but that's okay. Keith, thank you for joining us for the first half of the show. And Martin and Phil, thank you again for joining us for the second half of the show. On behalf of D20 Radio, the Order 66 podcast, and everybody else, this is GM Chris wishing you peace, love, and good gaming.
And keep them dice a rolling.
Hello?
Hello? Oh, look at that! Keith! As he pops in all of a sudden after we think he's dead.
No, I kept saying hello. I had muted my mic for a while, and I unmuted it, and you couldn't hear me after I unmuted it.
See?
Okay, this is three times a charm.
It's dude. Official.
It's official. Your mic sucks.
I'll agree with you.
Oh, that's just fantastic. All right. Okay, well, here we go.
This is Lord Vader, and I never listen to the Order 66 podcast, except for when I'm trying to weed out rebel scum.
Hello, this is Shibuta, co-host of the Small But Vicious podcast, just letting the Gamer Nation know that for nearly 3 years, I have not been listening to the Order 66 podcast.
This is Zoppy from Hungary, and I never listen to the Order 66 podcast.
D20 Radio, where gamers roll.
www.d20radio.com. This podcast and related websites are not endorsed by Lucasfilm Limited, 20th Century Fox, or Wizards of the Coast, and are intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. The official Star Wars site can be found at starwars.com. The official Wizards of the Coast site can be found at wizards.com. Star Wars, the Star Wars logo, D20 logo, D20 system references, all names, pictures of Star Wars characters, vehicles, and any other Star Wars related items are registered trademark and or copyright of Lucasfilm Limited, Wizards of the Coast, or their respective trademark and copyright holders. All original content of this podcast and its related website, including graphical, textual, audio, and visual information, is the intellectual property of the Order 66 podcast.
Post show.
Okay, so post-show time.
Post-show. Martin, Phil, are you guys able to stick around for a little bit?
Sure.
Ooh.
Wow.
Cyber-Phil.
Cyber-Phil? Sure.
Not only that, it was Tommy Two Time on top of that. I gotta go get the paper. Wow.
I have
a feeling that if he was using the... Was he the one that was using the Rock Band mic?
No, that's actually Martin.
No, that's me. Crystal clear the whole night. Just saying.
I mean, just...
I stole mine from work.
Ooh.
Wow, dude. It's like you're speaking through an electricity well.
You're digging bad.
Yeah, that's something.
All right, I'm going to try reconnecting with him. Oh, gosh. Well,
so,
okay,
cell phone is near it.
It could quite possibly be. Let me try and bring him back in.
Wow, dude. Wow.
Let me try and bring him back in. This is the episode of the audio snafus. Good grief.
I know. It's like the gnomes have it. I don't know. We have to get
it. We're chaotic, of course.
Maybe my mic is infecting theirs.
No. Dude, yours is actually behaving now.
There's a dangerous force when more than one gnome is collected in one location.
There it is. Robot Phil has disappeared. He has disappeared. And we have regular Phil back. Yay!
All right. So that was just a sign of my connection about to collapse.
Yeah, it was. I think that's exactly what it was, as a matter of fact.
Potentially. Okay. So I got to ask. So this is post-show, guys. We talk about whatever we want to talk about.
Hold on a sec.
Uh-oh. Here we go. Yes.
I'm holding on.
We're holding.
It's okay, Keith. We'll wait for you.
This episode, you're listening to continuing coverage of cell phone snafuage, courtesy of mapsofmastery.com.
Oh, heavens. Okay, Martin, Phil. So we talk about whatever during post-show, but I got to know, what games are you guys playing currently? What campaigns are you running?
I'm running, so right now I'm running, Blood and Honor. It's a John Wick game. It's a historical samurai game. I'm running
prepare,
that.
Prepare to feel inadequate because Phil runs like six games.
I don't run six games. I run Blood and Honor for one group every 3 weeks. And I just started, it's going to be a series of blog posts in the next week or so. I have forced myself into shortening my time to prep by running a weekly game of Corporation. It's a game out, by Mongoose Games out of the UK, and it's like the ultimate post-cyberpunk badass. I can't every sci-fi trope packed into one game. It's awesome. Love it.
Sounds cool.
Okay.
And go ahead.
As you say, see, not six games. I'm playing in like two other games, but I'm only running two.
Oh,
what do you,
see.
Okay, well, what are you playing in?
I'm also playing. So what we do is our group has a 3 week rotation. So the goal is we're all old married guys. Some of us have kids. And so we got a game every week, but there's no way everybody can run every week. So we have three GMs on a 3 week rotation. So I'm running Blood and Honor 1 week. And then I'm playing in a game of Firefly and a game of Icons. And then I'm running this one-off Corporation game with just two guys, and I'm just doing it weekly, again, as a way to force myself to shorten my prep and up my improv skills.
Nice. Very nice. So, Martin?
Beautiful. We're similarly, with one exception, old married guys, so... We also do a rotation thing, a little more organic. We usually do like a 2-on, 2-off, or a 3-on, 3-off kind of thing. So we just finished up 2-year-long D&D games, decided we were fantasied out. So I'm prepping for Star Trek using the Decipher rules and going to be playing in Shadowrun using the 4E rules.
Oh, come on. You're gonna do Shadowrun?
Yeah.
Martin knows my joke about Shadowrun. I'll share it with you guys. Shadowrun, for me, Shadowrun is like a bad girlfriend. Like every version, I buy it thinking it'll be different this time. And every time, all my stuff is out on the lawn.
Aww.
That's terrible. See,
and I buy every version thinking maybe I'll get to play it. So now, like... lightning has struck, and you know, next to my first edition copy from 1989 is the fourth edition copy I'll actually get to play.
Oh god. Wow.
See, all right, so now Keith is back. So what are you playing / running right now?
I'm running Star Wars, though I haven't done that in a while because people are moving away.
Oh,
that stinks.
That's
I've got a new
bummer.
Player lined up, but I'm trying to get everybody on the same schedule. That's nuts.
Dude, tell me about it.
Yeah.
Good grief. Our flagship game, you know, we managed to play in July, but we haven't managed to pull another game together yet, which is, God, I'm a new dad. I've got an 8 week old. So,
congratulations.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
Things are crazy.
Nuts even.
You're in the hallucination phase where you're not sleeping enough to actually tell reality from dreamland.
What, huh?
Yeah.
And then by the time you start actually getting some sleep, they're also mobile, so then you're screwed the other way.
I think I'm going to get a cage. Screw a crib. I'm just going to get a cage. Like one of those dog kennel things, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I've thought of that.
I'm just going to keep her in that, and when she gets unruly, I'll, you know, don't make me get the hose, you know, and then...
Jaina, kennel,
now.
I want an invisible fence for my kids. I thought that would also be a good...
Oh, that's perfect.
A good idea.
I'm telling you, your kid will outsmart that because my dad's dog did.
Well, you're assuming my kid is going to be very smart. She could not be. I'd like to hope she's going to be smart, but she could not be.
You just got to up the wattage then.
No, you don't. See, because if they move fast enough, the unit can just get the thing will buzz and it'll run through it before it zaps them.
Ah, so and then they're afraid to come back in, so then they just run away.
Right. Yeah.
My aunt had a dumbass terrier mix that had an IQ of like one. I mean, the dog was cross-eyed. It couldn't sit down. It would just like, it would try and sit and fall over. And it was named Oreo. And this dumb dog, man. It was stupid. And they put up the invisible electric fence and to keep it from leaving the yard, okay? And they put the collar on, and we watched the dog go, and for like 5 minutes. I mean, it got to the point that we just had to pull the dog away and take the collar off, and she had burns, okay?
Oh.
And, you know, I mean, stupid animal. Anyway.
She's like a sheep, and just look up when it rains and drown.
Drown, yes.
All right, so I'm going to ask you guys, where in Dallas are you guys located? Because I have family in Dallas, and I spent a year in Dallas when I was a kid.
Allen, just north of Plano.
Okay.
I'm in Louisville between Dallas and Denton.
Okay, I have family in Richardson.
That's where we work.
We work in Richardson. Ha ha.
Indeed.
Indeed, very, very nice. Man, I'm like, okay, so don't feel bad by saying no, I haven't. It's okay. Have either one of you guys played Star Wars Saga Edition?
Yeah, played it for 9 months, like just a cycle of games ago.
Awesome.
And I own it, but haven't played it.
Ah.
It made it to like number 3. My group does a kind of a like everybody gets to vote list when we want to play something new, and it was Star Trek, Shadowrun, Star Wars. So cycle it may float to the top.
Would you be, well, gosh, Martin, do you have the, I mean, obviously with your time constraints, do you guys ever do any online gaming? Like via Skype, map tools, stuff like that?
I actually have for two of my games. We actually have one player join via Skype every game.
Wow.
And that's actually worked out remarkably well.
Dave, I've never done any of it.
Really? Dave, I want to do that with Jake. We got to find a way to do that because Jake can Skype in.
Dude, you know,
we lost the player.
With video Skype now, there's no reason why he can't be.
Yeah. I got to talk to Jake about that.
We actually just, we have like a little TV table next to the game table, and we plunked the laptop on top of it with the camera on top facing the GM. And I think the best thing we wound up doing was we got a USB speakerphone, and it sits in the middle of the table so everyone can hear him. And we just connect up via Skype to the player. And, you know, one person who's sitting next to it will turn the camera to face players if the players are talking. But most of the time it sits on the GM. And, you know, we've had Skype connections up for like six hours straight without losing anybody.
I love Skype sometimes.
Yeah. Most of the time it's fine. It's just, you know, sometimes it throws shoes and, you know, generally behaves like a child.
The days I hate it, I curse its name.
Yeah, me too.
The next version is, what did they say? The thing I saw, the next version is going to have something like 10-way video conferencing.
Dude.
And that pretty much takes away every excuse I have of not doing a completely online game with all my high school friends who are scattered around the country.
That's fantastic.
Can you do maps and stuff?
Dude. With that, we play, we typically, we don't do maps anymore, but like I was playing Iron Heroes for a while and had a player Skype in for the last couple sessions. And basically we had to have like one of the player's jobs was to pick up the camera and kind of scan the table during combat so that player could see, you know, where their mini was and what was around them. And then they would just, you know, basically call out their move. It worked. I mean, it slowed things down a little, but, you know, it was worth having the player there than, you know, not having them there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and also I know, like, for all online games, I mean, where it's obviously you're not just one man out, I mean, there's a lot of great tools. There's Map Tools, which is free. And, gosh, I just did an online 4Ed game with one of the hosts of our other podcasts, Jared Glenn, who runs the Power Source podcast. And he used Map Tools entirely for that, and it worked very well.
Yeah, I've used Map Tools before. I'm just lazy. I like the prep to put the map in there and make all the counters, and then I wind up, I get lazy and I'm using like this. But short of that, the program itself is actually phenomenal.
It does impress me. I'm very cool. But I don't know, like Martin, I mean you seem like a gamer who's kind of strapped for time sometimes, dude. I recommend it if you can. It's a good way to get gaming in. You know, I like tabletops because it's face to face, but sometimes you gotta bite the bullet, I guess.
Yeah, we're pretty hardcore about getting together every week. It usually winds up being 3 weeks out of four for one reason or another. But
dude, that's really good. That's great.
Yeah, trying to squeeze in a second game would be rough.
That's really good though.
Yeah.
That's absolutely fantastic. Gosh.
Yeah, that's me.
I just received an email from Brev. Dave?
Oh, you did, huh?
He announces that for pre-order right now, The Pirates of Dark Water is finally available on DVD.
Oh.
That's awesome.
Gosh, I might have to own that. I'm slowly collecting pieces of my childhood.
Nice.
For Christmas.
How many seasons did they do of that show?
God, like two, I think? I don't know. For Christmas 2 years ago, I got the old Dungeons & Dragons cartoon, the complete set on DVD.
Oh, dude.
Awesome. I remember that.
Oh, I love those.
And I watched it, and then when you watch it now, it's like watching the Thundercats now. You realize how absolutely awful it was.
Yeah, well, still, is an icon of my childhood.
Yes, it is an icon of my childhood.
It was the Cavalier, right?
Yes, yep. the Cavalier.
The shield thing?
Yeah, he had the shield thing.
And the bow. The bow was the
flame bow.
Yes.
Yep. Yeah. And the one with the hood that she put up and she turned invisible.
That's right, Thief.
Yeah.
I think there's a set of the DVDs that comes with a book that has all the 3-5 stats.
Yes, that's the one. That's the set I was given. Yes.
Yeah.
And so it's like back when it looks like a miniature 3-5 book, and it's got all the stats of all the heroes and Venger, and
awesome.
A couple other threats. It's pretty trippy.
Awesome.
I will say. Yeah. Very, very cool.
Run out today. No, never mind. Well, gentlemen, we appreciate all of you being on the show. I'm sorry, I've got to wrap it up, but we have had a very nice discussion with you guys. For benefit of anybody who's listened through, the book was called Eureka, and it's, 501 adventure plots.
Correct.
And you guys can pick that up. Again, at the, I'm sorry, I put my show notes away now, and I've forgotten the name of the website that you said they can get the PDF.
EnginePublishing.com.
Engine Publishing. Yeah. Engine, spelled like the engine.
Yeah. Not like the other engine, but this engine.
That's right.
Yeah.
Exactly. All right.
Good
Martin,
night, Gamer Nation.
Yes, Martin, Phil, Keith, thank you guys very much for joining
thank
us.
Thank you. That was
thank
a lot
you.
Of fun.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. Thanks. Good night.
I apologize for my mic sucking.
Hey, look at that. Now see it at the end, it works
and
fine.
And now it works great. Perfect. Keith, it was good. It was good to have you on. Get better, man.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Feel better. Good night.
Yeah, I got to take a flight tomorrow. Hope I don't get the other passengers sick.
Cigar tube. Limited oxygen. Recycled air. No reason to think that'll happen.
Hi, I'm Martin Ralya. I am incredibly well endowed. And I never listen to the Order 66 podcast.
Hi, I'm DNA Phil from Gnome Stew, the game slut. And I never listen to the Order 66 podcast.